Well, happy Sabbath, everyone that's here, and happy Sabbath to everyone listening in. We've just had 8 days of a lot of these messages, so hopefully I'll get done with this message a little ahead of time, so we don't have to sit here right till the very last minute. And we've heard, something like 15, 16 messages in a week and a half, so that's a lot. It's a lot of setting. Well, I've decided to talk about humility. It's always been an interesting topic to me, and I'm going to start by looking at Strong's Concordance, first of all. And then Strong's number in the Old Testament is 6031. When I looked up in Strong's Concordance and Webster's Dictionary, I found that this word cuts a much wider swath than I had expected it to. First of all, in Strong's, humble talks about abasing myself, which surprised me. Abasing myself. To chasten myself. To afflict myself, which I did not expect. To browbeat myself. To submit myself to someone else, come under someone else's control, and to be gentle to all people at all times. Webster had a little bit more modern composition of this, and one area dealt with pride. The first area deals with pride. There's three areas here. And humility does not have pride. There is no pride with humility. And there's not any self-assurance. We don't have self-assurance and a self-aggrandizement. Humility is not arrogant, and humility does not require us to have our own way. Completely different. The second area is to be aware of my deceits. Be aware of my sins. Be aware of my shortcomings. Am I praying as much as I could? Am I missing Sabbath services just at random to visit someplace, to go someplace else? Am I missing Sabbath services? Am I doing enough Bible study? Those kinds of things that can creep in on us so easily. Because the world commands so much of our time, and our time is divided up. And the third area is to be lower in rank or lower in position. To humble and have a modest mind, to humble ourselves, and to be unpretentious. Well, from there, I decided to look up God's point of view. What was God's point of view about humility? Well, I went to Proverbs 3 and verse 34, where God inspired Solomon. What he says in this NIV Bible is that, this is Proverbs 3 and verse 34, God mocks proud mockers, but he gives grace to the humble. Now that was important enough to James to use that very same saying, to use Solomon's saying in James 4 and verse 6. Peter did exactly the same thing in 1 Peter 5 and verse 5. He quoted Solomon there. That particular point is used in three places that I know of in the Holy Scripture, once in the Old Testament and twice in the New Testament. Well, Christ comes along, or at least in this message he does, in Matthew 23, where the seven woes are. And what does he say in verse 12? If you exalt yourself, you are going to be humbled. However, if you humble yourself, you can be exalted. Well, this brings up an unusual thing that happened to me years and years ago. I was working for a big worldwide construction company at the time, and we had a large shop, and it had five bays in it. Two of them were dedicated to welding, and three of them were dedicated to repair and maintenance. I've got a big motor grater apart in one of these stalls, and the guy next to me had a forklift, which the engine was pulled out of, sent out, repaired, and was going to be put back in. So he puts it in, and things weren't right on it. At the beginning of this, I didn't know what was wrong. But later, the supervisor came over, two or three days later, after the engine had been running, and gets in a discussion with this other mechanic. And he was sort of a stubborn type, and he was proud, which is one of the things that Webster says is not part of humility. So this discussion goes on for a while, and it gets heated. And this mechanic did not want to do what the boss was telling him to do. He was defiant about it. So finally, they come to an understanding where he was going to do exactly what the boss told him to do, which he did, and the problem was solved. And what the problem was, he had hooked up a tiny coolant line, to an oil passage in the engine. So when the engine was started up, oil went into the coolant system. When the engine was shut down, coolant went back into the oil pan. Both things are terrible. But he wouldn't admit an error. And what happened? Wasn't long after that, he wasn't working there anymore. This is what God is talking about when he says he's going to abase the proud. I'd forgotten all about that until I was putting this message together. The company was generally forgiving about making mistakes. But most supervisors are not forgiving when you get in their face and want to defy them. That's too much pride, and they don't put up with it for too long. So from here, I'm going to move on to 2 Kings 5. 2 Kings 5 and verse 1. Okay, 2 Kings 5 and verse 1. This is the story of a man named Naaman. Naaman. 2 Kings 5 and verse 1 says, Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Assyria. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Eternal gave victories to Syria. And he was a valiant warrior. First of all, commander means that he was in charge of this entire Syrian army. Nobody was in higher command in the army than him. He was probably the fourth person or the third person, depending on how many sons the king had, in command of the entire nation. So we're talking about a political hierarchy here. And he was part of that. Being a great man means he had high social standings. So wherever there were social gatherings going on, Naaman was part of that. He was highly regarded by the king, and he was a Syrian. Both of them were Syrians. And he was highly regarded because of the victories God had given him, especially against Israel. Nobody liked Israel then, and it's hard for anybody to like them even today. We see resentment around the world against Israel. Okay, and he was a valiant soldier, which means he was very, very courageous, and on top of that, he was very wealthy, as you'll see here in a moment. Well, Naaman is a Syrian name, which means fair, gracious, and pleasant. But he had one big problem. Naaman was a leper. He was a leper, and he carried this mark on him every place he went. Verse 2 and 3, I'm going to paraphrase a lot of this because it's just easier to move through it like this. One day, his captive Israelite servant girl told Naaman's wife of a prophet of God in Samaria who will heal Naaman of his leprosy. There's a sentence in the New Testament that deals with this very point. It's in Luke 4. You don't have to turn it because I'm going to read it and come right back to 2 Kings. Luke 4 and verse 27. This is Jesus Christ speaking. And Christ has just given a sermon, an important sermon, and he's pointing out things after the sermon at this point. Verse 27 says, There were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet. Yet not one was healed, only Naaman the Syrian. Now, in our story at this point, the servant girl hasn't seen a single healing of anybody in that town or in that city or in Israel. Nobody had yet been healed, yet she said this was going to happen. Very unusual. Now we're back to Naaman again. So what does Naaman do in verse 5? He loads up 750 pounds of silver. He loads up 150 pounds of gold and a whole bunch of clothes, and then he gets a letter from the king of Syria requesting the king of Israel to heal Naaman. Now, the letter greatly angers the king of Israel. He tore his robes and he said, "Am I God? Can I kill? Can I make alive? This guy wants a quarrel with me." Well, Elisha hears that the king of Israel has tore his robe. So he says to the king, I believe through a servant, he says, "Send him to me." Well, Naaman now takes his men, his horses, his chariots, right to Elisha's front door. Now, an odd thing happens here. Elisha does not even go out to greet Naaman. He stays in the house. But he sends his servant with the instructions, "Go wash 7 times in the Jordan River, and you'll be healed, and your flesh will be restored." Now, you'd think that Naaman would be really happy about that. He's going to get over this and he'll be clean the rest of his life. No. You see, Naaman now feels mistreated. He feels belittled by Elisha because Elisha didn't come out there, didn't come out to greet him, didn't even come out and say hello. He expected to see Elisha come out and what? Sprinkle some holy water, perhaps? Don't know. Wave his arms around, pray a little bit, and so on. He didn't come out at all, didn't greet him a bit. And here is a very wealthy man, the highest officer in the entire Syrian army is standing at his door and he doesn't come out. Well, Naaman is now furious. He's upset. He's beside himself and he leaves in a huge rage. He has no intention of dipping in that river. So what happens? Humility enters here. His servants start to point out to Naaman that if Elisha had told him to go climb some mountain, he would have done it. To go do some impossible task, he'd have done it. He wouldn't have quit until he had done it. If he was to do some great thing, this warrior, this general would have went and did it. But all he's telling you to do is go dip in the river. Go in the river 7 times to wash. That's all he's telling you to do. Well, what do you suppose happens? Why not just go wash in the river 7 times? Naaman now swallows his pride and repents. He is not proud. He is not assertive. He abases himself and he submits himself to his servants. Submits himself to his servants. He lowers himself in rank and he's modest because he goes and dips in the river. Now we humbly see that he humbly obeys Elisha and starts to dip in the Jordan River. So he goes in the first time and what happens? Comes out, his arms still have all this leprosy. Goes in a second time, looks at his fingers, his hands, they have all this leprosy. The third time, they have all this leprosy. At some point, doesn't he have to say, you know what, this isn't working? The problem is, it's not progressive. You don't get a little better and a little better and a little better. You go in 6 times and it's a total failure, and you come out the 7th time clean. He had to go 7 times. But what's going through his mind all during this time? He's got to do this thing 7 times. Well, did the seventh time bring him what he asked for? Absolutely. He was totally healed the seventh time. Verse 15. Second Kings 5 and verse 15 says, "Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God," the very person that would not even come out and talk to him. "He stood before him, stood man to man, and said, 'Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. Please accept now a gift from your servant.'" You see, he puts himself, the mighty warrior of a great nation, puts himself under the control of the prophet. And Elijah said, "I don't want your silver and I don't want your gold." Well, that's not quite the end of the story. Verse 17, Naaman says, "If you will not take the silver and the gold, please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the eternal. No Baal, no Ashtar, nothing. It's going to be to the eternal." So what happens? Go in peace. These two men parted in peace in verse 17. He went home a happy man. The girl's prediction came to pass, even though it had never happened before. This was the only time it happened. So her prediction was right. Okay, so let's move on from here. We're going to go to David. Talk about David for a little bit. This will be in 1 Samuel 25. 1 Samuel 25 is where we're going to start. Well, David, and he's not king yet. He's not the king. Saul is still the king. And David and his 600 men have protected Nabal's 4,000 sheep and goats. They protected him from rustlers. They protected him from poachers and so on. Anybody who was going to come along and poach a sheep or steal a sheep or something had to deal with these 600 men. And that's at Carmel, which Bill has already mentioned. Well, today's a happy day for Nabal, because today he's out shearing his sheep, shearing the wool, for money. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. We know what that sound is. It's money dropping in the slot machine, and we're pulling down a lever, we're winning. So David hears about this and sends 10 men to meet, greet, and bless Nabal, and ask for some compensation for all the good David did in protecting him. Verse 11, Nabal, whose name, by the way, means fool, and if you don't like to use that name, you could use the name stupid, or you could use the name wicked, or you could use the name vile. The good, bad, and ugly, he's definitely not the good. Well, anyway, Nabal viciously rebuffs them and claimed he'd never heard of David. Now, this had to be a ruse because David, even though he was not king, went against Goliath and took him down. And everyone in Israel knew that. So it's a personal insult to David. Not only did everyone in Israel know it, every one of the Philistines knew it too. So anyway, that's what happened at that point in time. So now his 10 men, David's 10 men, return to tell David of Nabal's bad treatment. David says only four words: "Put on your swords." Today, we would say, "Grab your AK-47s. So now there are 400 warriors, 200 of them stayed back in camp. There are 400 warriors now leave, and they're bent on destruction and killing. Well, Nabal's wife is not told of the impending massacre. Now, she's told about it now. She didn't know about it originally. And they're not too many miles away. David is on the move. He's moving. Well, Nabal's wife is named Abigail. Abigail, which means, listen to this, it's beautiful. My father is my joy. My father is my joy. How beautiful is that? Well, Abigail immediately springs into action. She takes 200 loaves of bread, 200 cakes of figs, 100 clusters of raisins, 60 pounds of roasted corn, 5 sheep that she was already preparing, 2 skins of wine, and loads them on the donkeys and tells her servants, go ahead of me, I'm going to follow you. Well, being a wise woman that she is, she did not tell her husband Nabal just yet. Well, here comes David. David comes along now in verse 21. And he's upset. He's lamenting things as Abigail approaches from this other side. They're going to meet in the valley here in a few minutes. But see, David is upset also. And he says, it's been useless, useless, useless. He said, watching over this man's property, it's been useless. So there was nothing missing? He does me this way? He pays me back evil for good? This is useless. It was useless. I wasted my time with this guy. Then he says, if I leave one male alive before morning, may God punish me. He placed himself under an oath. He wants to be put down by Almighty God if he doesn't bring this about. So David is angry. Now here comes Abigail. We're going to see what Abigail is doing here in a moment. And this is in verse 23. That's where we're going to start. We're going to go to verse 31. And we're going to see Abigail's humility in these verses. It's amazing. She is not proud and she's not assertive. But she abases herself. She submits herself to David. She does not need to have her own way either. She chastens herself. She puts herself down. She lowers herself to the level of a servant and in that rank. She's also unpretentious. She is very, very humble. We're going to begin in verse 23. Let's begin in verse 24. This is from the NIV. 1 Samuel 25 and verse 24. She fell at David's feet, meaning she got off her horse and got down on her hands and knees. My Lord, she addresses him, let the blame be on me alone. I'm at fault. Let me take the blame. First thing out of her mouth. Can you believe that? Is that humility or is that humility? Please. Please is the equivalent of saying thank you. She's very courteous in this point. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my Lord David pay no attention to that wicked man, Nabal. See how she categorized her husband there? He is just like his name. His name is Fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master David sent. Now, since the Eternal has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, as surely as the Eternal lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal. And let this gift which your servant has brought to my master, that's David she's talking about, she's talking to him also, be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's offense, for the Eternal will certainly make a lasting dynasty of my master because he fights the Eternal's battles. Let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live, even though someone is pursuing you to take your life. Here she's talking about King Saul wanting David dead and is pursuing him. She understands the political scene of the day and she understands military jargon of the day. The life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living, by the Eternal your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. When the Eternal has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. When the Eternal has brought my master success, remember your servant. That's beautiful. Very intelligent gal. And she knew how to speak, and she knew how to humble herself. This is how God expects his saints to conduct their lives, with humility, modesty, and repentance, and submission. Was Abigail's approach a wise one? Well, let's find out. Verse 32, next verse. David is now speaking. He says to Abigail, "Praise be to the Eternal, to the God of Israel who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment." See, when you read through this slowly, you can see that she was very wise and composed a beautiful blessing here on David. "May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Eternal, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." See, David is bearing himself to her like she did to him. Now, when he says, "who has kept me from harming you," what he's talking about is not that they would have killed Abigail. Something worse would have happened. When they killed Nabal's son, let's say that he had three boys, he would have also been murdering her three sons because they were married. They were as much Abigail's sons as they were Naaman's sons. So he would have been harming her a lot by murdering those three boys. I don't know how many children they had, or if they had any, I don't know that. But I'm just pointing that out. That's what he was talking about. So David now says in verse 35, "Go in peace, I grant your request." Now, Abigail's humility avoided a huge amount of bloodshed that day. In verse 38, Abigail tells her husband the story the next morning. And Nabal has a heart attack and is dead in 10 days. He dies in 10 days. Verse 39, you'll find that David now asks Abigail to marry him. They marry, and I'm sure that she gives some or all of Nabal's property and livestock to her new husband, David. He didn't have to kill anybody to receive this blessing. Nobody died at his hands. Nabal died from some sort of a heart attack, or that's probably what it was. And we see through all of this that there's humility on both sides. There's humility with Abigail. There's humility with David. And humility works. The only person that did not have humility died for it. What does Solomon say in Proverbs 16? Proverbs 16 and verse 19. It's almost as if this scripture was written for this incident. Proverbs 16 and verse 19 says, better to be lowly in spirit and among the oppressed than to share plunder with the proud. David was about to take plunder, and all of his men would have been drinking wine, and they'd have been saying what they did to this guy, what they did to that guy. They'd have been so proud of themselves. David, perhaps the same. I don't know. But that's what happens when there's a huge victory. Everybody brags about it. But here Solomon is saying it's better to be lowly in spirit, which they both were, and among the oppressed, than to share plunder with the proud. Verse 18 also is very fitting. This could be Nabal. Nabal's name could be here. Pride goes before instruction, before destruction. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Okay, from here, I'm going to go on to Nebuchadnezzar. Whenever I write this word out, Nebuchadnezzar's name, there's 14 letters in it, and I think, I'm glad I don't have a name with 14 letters where I have to write it out like that all the time. Five is enough. So, Nebuchadnezzar's name is short compared to some of the email addresses that you have. It's just amazing. We've got a lot of numbers in them. What's always amazing to me about Nebuchadnezzar is that he only takes up 4 chapters in the book of Daniel, but you hear about him, it seems like as if he's throughout the Bible, which he is in other areas, but it just seems like it's you hear about him a lot more than he is in Daniel. Anyway, in Daniel 4, I had it here and I got rid of it. Daniel 4, starting in verse 4. Nebuchadnezzar is writing this chapter, and he's had a bad dream, and it terrifies him. He's scared about this dream. Well, the king finally asked Daniel to interpret the dream, as no enchanter, astrologer, no diviner could even touch the dream. They all failed. Nebuchadnezzar said, "The spirit of the holy God is in you." Well, indeed, Daniel did explain the dream. And Daniel was humble. He was modest. He was unpretentious. He was gentle to everybody. And he basically said in verse 26, "No good thing will come to you, O king, until you humble yourself and acknowledge," humble yourself and acknowledge, "that the eternal God rules in the kingdom of men." Not only the kingdom of heaven, right down here on this earth. And he rules in Babylon, and you don't quite know that yet. Well, Daniel's advice to the king, to King Nebuchadnezzar, is to repent. To be humble, to be modest, to be unpretentious. What about being merciful? What about being kind and gentle? Well, that went with it. Well, when Nebuchadnezzar, being who he was, did not change one iota. Didn't change one bit. A year later comes along, and he's still proud. He's still arrogant. He's still puffed up. He's bragging about his might. He's bragging about his power, bragging about his majesty and his honor. And at that very moment, God takes him down. What, through a sword, through a spear, through poison? No. Through insanity. He takes him down through insanity. For the next 7 long years, he is going to be insane, just as the Eternal revealed to him through Daniel. Now, 7 years from 2017 is 2010. 7 years ago, I was still in my 60s. 7 years ago, how old were you? That's the time that he was under this curse. In that time, Anna and I have been to the Feast of Tabernacles in Oceanside, Bend, Sevierville, Branson, Gatlinburg, and I think up in Colorado Springs. I'm not positive about that part. But anyway, it's a lot of time has gone by. And it's a lot for all of us. But it took that long for some reason for him to come to his senses. Verse 33 of Daniel 4 is a description of a day in the life of Nebuchadnezzar. I'm sure that he was looked after probably by some people in his family and some of his staff as well. I'm going to read verse 33 of Daniel 4. Immediately, what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. In other words, Daniel had told him what the dream was going to be, and now it's coming to pass 12 months later. He was driven away from people, number one. And number two, he ate grass like cattle. Number three, his body was drenched with the rain of heaven. Number four, until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle. And number five, if that wasn't enough, his nails were like the claws of a bird. After 7 long years, Nebuchadnezzar finally humbles himself. In verse 34, we're going to see that there's no pride. The arrogance is not here. He's not assertive, but he's humble and modest. He is humble in rank, he's low in rank, and he's low in position, and he is unpretentious. Verse 34 says, at the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. He knew his kingdom was not going to endure past his life. Verse 35. He knows his position and rank, and he is submitting himself here in verse 35. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. Nothing. He's including himself in this. All peoples are nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and exactly what Daniel was talking about with the peoples on the earth. God rules on the peoples of the earth, and Nebuchadnezzar finally understood that. And he says, no one can hold back his hand or say to him, what are you doing? After this, Nebuchadnezzar is in charge for a little while, and he begins to become greater than ever in verse 36. At the same time, my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor returned to me for the glory of my kingdom, and my advisors and nobles sought me out. It's amazing. And I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. Humility is greater than arrogance. And he's pointing that out right here. Humility is greater than arrogance. Verse 37, here's the final result. Look at this great attitude. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Well, 1 Samuel 2 and verse 30 seems to fit this situation pretty well. I'm going to read 1 Samuel 2 and verse 30. Because we can read these things from the New Testament, but they're all over the Old Testament as well. Last half of verse 30 says, those who honor me, I will honor. But those who despise me will be disdained. Finally, the reverse happened. God was disdained at the beginning, and he was honored at the end of Nebuchadnezzar's life there. The last person we're going to talk about here is Rahab in Joshua 2. Joshua chapter 2 and verse 1. Joshua 2 and verse 1. Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two spies from Shittim. "Go look over the land," he said, "especially Jericho." So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. So Joshua sent these two spies out to search out the land, especially Jericho. This is peculiar because Ai is now the only other city left where two other spies are sent out. Why is that? Why were spies sent to Jericho? Why weren't they sent to every single city? They were not sent to every single city. They were first sent to Jericho. Why? Why did God inspire Joshua to send these two spies? Why? Why go to Jericho? After all, the battle plans were already laid out. Walk around the city once a day for 6 days. Seventh day, walk around the city seven times. The battle plans are already there. They just aren't laid out here to Joshua at this point in time. But that's how the battle was going to go. The walls were going to fall down, and God knew it already. Why did he have to send two spies to Jericho? Did God have another reason, a completely different reason for going to Jericho? Remember the two spies that came along with God when he talked to Abraham and told Abraham and Sarah they were going to have a baby? Remember those two spies that went into Sodom? Remember that? They went in there and they brought out the righteous people. He brought out Lot and his family. Did God do exactly the same thing here and sends two spies in to remove Rahab and her family from Jericho and save her family just like he did in Sodom? That's exactly what happened. Did these two spies just accidentally come in contact with Rahab? Did she just casually bump into these two men? They didn't know one another. Spies didn't know one another in Sodom either. If Rahab had tried to leave the city with her mother, her father, her brothers, her sisters, her sons and daughters, and so on and so on, I wonder how far they would have gotten. Would the king let them get away? So Rahab hides the two spies until it's dark, and she strikes a covenant with them. I saved your life, now you save my life. Joshua 2 and verse 16, I won't read it, but she helps them escape and gives them advice on how to go and where to go, which was the opposite of the Jordan River, and to hide for 3 days and nights until the soldiers return. The Jordan River was over to the east, and the plain is relatively smooth between Jericho and the Jordan River. However, she told them to go the opposite direction, up to the mountains, where there's ravines, there's caves, there's riverbeds, and so on, creeks and stuff coming out of the mountains. She said, stay up there until you see these troopers come back, and then come down out of the mountains, after you see them come back, and just go on and go right over there to Jericho, where the rest of your people are. Well, that's what she did there with those two spies. I'm going to read verse 8, Joshua 2 and verse 8 through 12. I'll begin at verse 9. I know that the eternal, the true God, the living God, has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us. And that's correct, because they were very afraid. You can see her humility here. She's admitting to these kind of things already. Great fear has fallen us that you who live in this so that all who are living in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the eternal, the ever-living God dried up, the true God, dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. That was 40 years before this. 40 long years, and she knew about it, and she brought that topic up right here. And what you did to Shion and Og, two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, who you completely destroyed. So everybody, including her, realized that, and they realized that this was going to happen to them. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and everybody's courage failed because of you. For the eternal, your God, is God in heaven above and on earth below. Now then, please swear to me by the eternal, okay? I don't want a handshake. I want your hand shaking. I want you to swear by the eternal God who lives forever that you're going to save my life. I want you to take a vow with God's name in it. She wasn't going to settle for some handshake. Swear to me by the eternal that you will show kindness to my family because I have shown kindness to you. And so on. Okay. From there, Joshua 6 and 22, the trumpets now sound. In the meantime, what has happened is the Israelites have walked around Joshua on the first day, walked around on the second day, walked around on the third day. What do you suppose Rahab is doing? I think she'd be praying. I think she'd be praying and praying and praying. Those 3 days, the next 6 days. Then when they walk around on the seventh day, seven times, I think she'd be praying too. I think she'd be realizing that this thing was just about over. They were about to attack. Well, the destruction of Jericho here is beginning, and her humility was rewarded because Joshua says, go into the harlot's house, bring her out, and all who belong to her. Now, what a blessing. Because of her humility, she's saved from death. Well, Israel burned the whole city and everything in it. They burned it to the ground. Rahab's faith and humility allowed her to escape this terrible disaster. In Hebrews 11 and verse 31, Hebrews 11 is the faith chapter. She's actually talked about here. Hebrews 11 and verse 31. By faith, the prostitute Rahab became, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient, or in other words, unbelieving. She believed and the rest did not. She came through this alive. Not only that, in Matthew 1, Rahab married a Jew named Salmon. And together they became the great-great-grandparents of King David. And Rahab is in the bloodline of Jesus Christ. What a small group of people out of the billions who have lived. She's in that small little bloodline of I don't know how many women, probably less than 60, I'm guessing. 50 or 60 or so, it probably could be figured out. I just didn't do it. But there's 60 guys and 60 gals in that, and that is a very, very tiny, minute minority of all the people, of all the people that have been born on this earth. It's just amazing. So humility is better than being proud and being noisy and being boisterous. The last story I've got is one that an incident that happened to me about 3 years ago. And what took place, I went to the grocery store and picked up some stuff, and I had 4 bags of groceries, and I went out and left 2 of them there and didn't realize it. And I told them to throw away the receipt. You talk about stupidity. We're our own worst enemy, and that's what happened right there. So anyhow, I go home and I find two bags missing. Well, they're out in the car, no problem. I go out there, they're not there. Walk out in the street and nobody's running away with any bags of groceries. So now I know I got to go back. I got to go back and argue with the manager over this thing if I can't find them. So I go in the store, and the first thing I do is go over to the checker. No groceries. Go to the next checker. Look around, look around. Look around the back of the thing where they had would probably have stored the bags. They weren't there. Now, I got to go to the manager, and I don't have a receipt. And this is embarrassing. I'm telling you. This is terrible. I go over to him, and I tell him my story. And he said three words to me. Extremely humble he was. He said, "I believe you." I couldn't believe it. Now, does that story have an ending? It has a great ending. Because of that, because of his attitude and his humility and his modesty, that store is the first store I go back to every single time I want something because I was treated like a man. I wasn't questioned. I wasn't lied to. There weren't any excuses. Well, what about this? What about that? He just told me, go pick up what you are missing and come and see me. He escorted me out the door. So, brethren, humility pays. It pays off all the time. It pays off bigger than being proud. Have a great Sabbath.